Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. Peter Reith was a minister in the Howard government. He oversaw the early round of industrial relations changes, and later he was Minister for Defence during the notorious Children Overboard incident, before he retired at the 2001 election. These days, he's still a familiar face. He's a frequent commentator in the media on politics. And recently he released the Reith Papers, a book based on his diaries at the time. He joins us today. Peter Reith, you follow today's politics closely. How different are things from the years you document in the Reith Papers?
Well, not as much as some people would suggest. Clearly, with social media and technology having some impact, perhaps increasing the tempo of politics in some ways, but basic issues are still there and we're still debating many of them.
Can you give us a feel for the dynamics of the Howard cabinet? For many liberals and commentators these days, the Howard years have become a sort of gold standard, but my impression was at the time that they were much more up and down than we now remember them as. What's your impression?
Well, I don't put those two propositions together. I think the truth is that there is a lot of ups and downs in the business of government. There are many interests to be responded to, and it can be pretty messy politics. That's the nature of the democratic system. I think, though, the Howard government can also say at the same time that it certainly reached the gold standard on a number of key issues for the country.
So I think of
workplace relations, obviously, as a minister. I had that responsibility. I think the changes to the relationship with the Reserve Bank was an important reform in itself. The fiscal policy position of the Howard government was better than others could claim, and more could be said about that, but it was still a good job on their part. And other, you know, important changes that they made, including, of course, the stopping of the boats, which was a big issue as well.
Of course, on a couple of those, tax reform, while it was achieved, was a pretty fraught process on the way through. And in the second iteration of workplace relations, when you safely departed, the government overshot.
Well, they did, and they made one mistake. They fixed that mistake before the 2007 election, but
this was the no disadvantage test.
Yes, and unfortunately the issue had got away from them. I, of course, had no doubts about the introduction of the no disadvantage test. It was one of the pillars of, I think, one of the success of most of the time of the Howard years.
Now, you and Peter Costello were rivals while you were both there. How did that work out in day-to-day relations?
The thing to remember, of course, is that Peter and I agreed on a lot of the economic policies. And so whilst there were clear rivalries, they were perhaps as much about personality as anything else.
And ambitions.
And ambitions was the real issue, I think. But, you know, that's just standard politics, let's face it. You know, when the extracts of my book came out and Peter said, oh, well, we weren't rivals, well, I'm not sure that I believed that one or anybody else would have either. But, you know, again, this is, you know, politics. It has its frustrations. It has people have their ambitions. But most people, most of the time, amongst the ministers, they're pretty focused on their own portfolios and most of them are fairly keen to get on with it and, you know, show that they can do what needs to be done.
In the fairly early days of the government, you were perhaps equal rivals, you know, equal with a chance of eventually becoming leader. Mm-hmm. When did you feel that your ambitions were very unlikely to be fulfilled? In other words, when did Peter Costello overtake you as a possible heir apparent, although, of course, he never got the crown?
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, You know, I took a pretty big blow over the question of the Telstra card, even though I didn't actually know that it was being used. But
this was a card that your son had access to.
Yes, he did. And like always with these things, it's all absurdly, you know, exaggerated. The bureaucrats knew what was going on, but decided not to tell me. I mean, you know, all those things are sort of what happens pretty regularly in some of these areas. But look, really, your prospects eventually, though, really are a question of your own determination. And look, I was ambitious, keen to sort of do my best, but in the end, I didn't really have the commitment to want to go on and on. I think there are lots of examples of people who have had setbacks and then still made it eventually. Mm-hmm. And I suppose at one stage I thought, well, yes, I think Peter is pretty obviously ahead, although he never really had that strong support, you know, even right up through till 2007.
Do you think that if John Howard had stepped down in 2007, Peter Costello could have won that election?
Well, one or two of my mates who were in the whip's office reckoned that he never had more votes than about 28 to 32, something like that. And Peter was one of these people who tended to polarise his supporters, and he lost quite a lot of support, in my view. He might have got there, but it's not entirely certain that he would have.
In the electorate?
In the electorate. And no, in the party room.
But in the electorate, if Howard had stepped down of his own choice?
Well, the first question is, are the MPs in the party room going to give you the top job?
Well, there was no one else, though, was there?
Well, I don't think so, but look, you know, no, that's probably right. I mean, he probably would have got there if he'd wanted to, but...
But would he have won the election?
Well, he probably would have as well, I think, but... These are just unknowns, let's face it. The point about 2007 that should not be forgotten, though, is that the Australian public have a pretty long-standing view, which is after a period of time, it's time to change the government. And so whether or not Peter would have got up, he, in some ways, against his opponent, he had the upper hand, but he also would have faced the reality that the public think a changeover is often regularly required.
Just to go to the children overboard incident, when the government wrongly asserted that asylum seekers had thrown their children into the sea, you reaffirm in your book that you relied on the advice of the Chief of the Defence Force. Mm-hmm. But in retrospect, would you have handled the incident differently?
Well, not really, because my source of advice was from the CDF. And he never changed his position whilst I was there. And the way he presented it was that he'd had a lot of experience. His experiences were, in an operational sense, from the Navy. And he used to say, well, the first statement... you know, is the one you should normally accept unless there's other, you know, information to the contrary. So I thought what he said was quite reasonable. I wasn't terribly happy about it because even within 24 hours there was some uncertainty about the timing of the event, and I just said, well, look, I don't want somebody to just ring me up and tell me over the phone. If they really want to tell me what's actually happened, well, I want a proper process before I'm going to move my position. At the moment, until I've got something more substantial that people are prepared to stand for, I'm going to stick with the CDF. And I thought that was the right thing to do. It's also, I think, fair to say that even now today, people, you know, talking about this issue, you know, really look at it completely out of proportion. I mean, no one died. There was no drowning. And yet there was over 1,000 people who drowned in the events that, you know, followed with the change of government. when Labor changed their approach to the issues.
One thing I was interested in what you've written is that, going right back, you refer to the opposition period under John Hewson and say, and I quote, "In many ways they were great days. Hewson was a breath of fresh air and he brought a new standard of policy debate, showing how good opposition could set the agenda." But in fact, of course, he lost the election and many people thought that he was a lesson in how you shouldn't go too far. You obviously have a rather different view.
One of the things to remember about the fight back is that whilst Labor claimed it to be full of radical ideas, the truth is that fight back was full of mainstream ideas on how you manage the economy of a modern society. And what was so refreshing about Hewson is that he was prepared to put these ideas on the table and fight for them. Mm. And whilst, yes, we lost that election, when I think of the Howard years, and obviously the best example of that was the GST, which was finally secured in the 1998 election, in my view, it never would have happened but for the fact that we fought so hard for it back in 1993 and fight back. So I think in one sense, history should be a bit fairer about the role of John Hewson, because setting the standard of good policy is something that should be celebrated, not scoffed at on the basis, well, he lost.
Can we turn to some contemporary issues? John Howard was very tough on ministerial standards in his very early days and a number of heads rolled. But then, after losing several front benches, he decided he'd stand behind almost everyone, whatever they did. Now, we're in the midst of another debate in another government about ministerial standards. Do you think that Malcolm Turnbull should ask Mal Brough to stand aside or even stand down completely?
I've looked at the alleged evidence so far, and to me there simply isn't enough to require him to stand down. And it's so often the case. Look, the Labor Party, they'd like to get rid of every minister. Of course they would. Bringing down ministers is their way to get back into government. I can understand that. But you've got to have a substantial case. And as we all know, this is all about politics. I mean, if they were really genuine about it, they'd say, well, until a court decides one way or another, you're not guilty. And I think it's, as usual, completely exaggerated. How Malcolm Turnbull's going to deal with the issue? Well, it's also the case that, certainly on many occasions, prime ministers make the decision on the basis of, is this doing too much damage to the government? And in fact, in the Reith papers, I refer to that comment by John Howard on the first day that we had a cabinet meeting in 1996, and I dare say that rule still applies.
You were there during the big debate around the introduction of the GST, and they were wild days at times. It was a difficult tax to bring in, obviously, but is it time to either increase it or broaden it or both, and how tough would that be?
Well, it'd be pretty tough on the broadening, for starters. I don't think you're going to get the Senate to agree to taxing food. I think we didn't get that in 1998, and there's hardly anybody in the Western democracies who've got it except for New Zealand. So I don't think you're going to get a broadening. There's some talk about the finance sector being subject to the broadening, but when we did the numbers back in the fight back days and in 1998, it was a question of practicality. So until I'm told that it today could be practical when it wasn't practical in the past, then I'm not convinced by that at all. And the other big areas are health and education, and you've got a lot of churning there, and I don't think that's such a good idea. So I need a lot of convincing on the broadening. And then when you get to the increase, well, it's only a 5% increase, and of that 5%, about a third of it goes in compensation. And then you've got, you know, a few dollars going to income tax, maybe some corporate tax, and then of course there's some of these states and they want their hand out as well. So when you look at it, where's the big economic reform as a result of that change? It's not a lot. There's not a lot left over, basically. And so you're then looking at a situation of taking putting a lot of your credibility on the line for not a very big reform. So I have my doubts about the whole idea.
Not worth the trouble?
Probably not worth the trouble.
So what would you do about tax at the moment?
Well, I think the superannuation one needs to be looked at. I think, you know, this idea that, you know, people with large amounts of money should be getting all these benefits. I wasn't there when those arrangements were made, but I don't think I would have supported them then. I don't think I find them a good idea now.
So that's the main area you think needs tax?
Well, that's one. I mean, there's probably a whole lot of others you could be looking at it as well. But for the GST, it's not convincing in my view, and there are other areas that need to be addressed. And, of course, they still need to do more on the spending side. But that's, of course, I appreciate that's a difficult one.
Mm. Now, the Turnbull coup has obviously turned around the polls, but it's now having some fallout. How damaging do you think the Abbott anger is, and in particular, his hitting out at Julie Bishop?
Well, I think I wouldn't put a lot of weight on, you know, individual personal shots one at the other sort of situation. And more generally, from a political point of view, the notes, the comments just recently in the last few days making the point from Abbott's supporters that his failure to respond to the party room concerns about his office, I think in a way weaken their ability to be saying he was badly treated, because the truth of the matter is there are a lot of people who are very concerned about the way in which the office was run and decisions were made. And so I suppose we'll still get, you know, some people making some complaints, but they're not in a strong position. And in fact, I think in some cases, for some of those who have spoken out, I think they need to be careful about their own reputations, because, you know, if you talk to people, for example, in the business community, they've accepted it. They thought it was necessary. And whatever people think about Tony, and he did some good things, and I think he should get credit for that, but I think the overwhelming view in the electorate, and certainly in the Liberal Party generally, is that it's time to move on, and we've got a new leader, and we've got to make sure we win the next election.
Do you think he should move on for his own sake and for the government's sake?
Well, I don't sort of...
Of Parliament.
Well, I don't feel inclined to tell somebody they should leave the Parliament. I mean, that's a decision for him. But, I mean, it's pretty obvious, whether he likes it or not, if he stays in and occasionally makes a comment, however reasonable that comment might be, there are people who will twist it against him. So, you know, it does therefore put him in a situation where he's going to keep his head down for, you know, quite a while before he can make some sort of, you know, place for himself in a renewed and Turnbull government coming into office next year.
Do you think he may be deluded and think he could make a comeback to the leadership?
Well, I think there are some people in the media who are rather keen for him to, you know, wait for his great moment to perhaps charge back into the top job. I think I don't think that they're doing him a favour, quite frankly, by encouraging that thinking, if that's what's going on.
And it would seem that the Rudd model is a one-off, wouldn't it? That Rudd's resurrection was based on his electoral popularity, and Abbott doesn't have that weaponry.
Well, that's probably true, but, you know, we both know, you know, you can take a punt as to where you think things are going to go, and then it goes the other way. Who knows where it would end up?
Do you think that the Liberal Party is getting too factionalised, though? This does reflect a fair degree of factionalism at the moment.
There is a bit of factionalism around, a bit more than I had to deal with, I suppose, going back to the 1980s and the 1990s. It's certainly not very useful to anybody, in my opinion. You know, people who claim to be conservatives, I mean, for heaven's sake, what do they actually mean by that? I mean, do they just want to leave things as they are? You know, the sort of traditional view of what conservative means? Well, I don't suppose that is it. And, well, of course, you know, those who claim to be reformists don't have a lot to show in terms of reform during the Abbott years. So, again, you want to make trouble, but you don't have a strong position based on your own performance, it's a bit of a problem.
Do you have sympathy with those who say that we need at the moment to be more willing to debate the role of Islam and the role of religion in the terrorist threat? The sort of sentiments that Josh Frydenberg, for example, came out with.
Well, Josh Frydenberg's comments, I thought, were entirely justified and pretty fairly put as well. We certainly don't want people to have a sense that it's somehow, you know, out of bounds to be talking about these issues. I think that's a great mistake for everybody if people feel that they're obliged to keep their mouths shut. No, there's got to be open discussion about these issues. Of course there should be. You know, and can I just say, going back to Tony Abbott, I mean, I think there were problems in the Abbott government which led to his demise. But generally speaking, he was good, particularly on foreign affairs, you know, on a whole lot of challenges that we've had to face. And you can talk about some of the words that he used on, in part of that, you know, general discussion. But, you know, he set a pretty good standard.
You don't
as far
think
as I'm
he
concerned.
Overstated, beat up the terrorist story
well,
too much?
Look, there might be some words that I mightn't have used. I would say that's true. But I don't think that should be exaggerated either. Mm. I mean, and even the question about, you know, boots on the ground, I mean, I'm not sure that it was perhaps good timing to say that when it has been said. But, you know, a lot of people have thought about that and could see that being the situation. It's not simple because...
And we're seeing some changes in American policy.
Well, I was just going to say...
In the last 24 hours.
The Americans have been saying no, but actually been putting a few people in here and a few people there. And, you know, who knows what the position's going to be in 12 months' time. So I think he should... To go back to the factional side, it's a pity, you know, when people want to play games, when there are positive things that should be said about Tony. You know, because he has done some good things, and he did well on the international stage. He did well on the stopping the boat people. He did well on the carbon tax. You know, the taxing, the mining tax. You know, these were key parts of what he was doing. So, when people are sort of, you know, grumpy about the changeover, they're also taking away the real opportunity for the celebration of the things that you did get right.
Just finally, how easy or hard is it to build a life after parliamentary politics? You obviously keep your hand in the political arena still. Is the pull of politics always there?
Oh, I think once you've got it in the blood, it's sort of hard to get it out.
Infection? No antibiotics?
Well, I was lucky because I got, you know, jobs for the boys and went off to London for 6 years, and I enjoyed that, and it took me out of the political thing. When I got back, people were, you know, within hours of arriving home, people were saying, oh, why don't you come up to the parliament, or why don't you go and do this, or go and do that for the Liberal Party, etc., etc. So you get sort of brought back in a bit. But I think you have to, as long as you're realistic about it. I mean, I'm on the outskirts, you know, it's all very well for commentators like me to say what the other side should be doing now, etc. You know, I've got a view about things and I'll continue to state those, but, you know, you're on the outside. I enjoy it. It's all good fun. It's interesting. It's in the public interest, I think, as well. But you don't make too much money. But I think it's also the reality. You have it in your blood. But what else are you going to do as well? That's a question for a lot of people.
Peter Reith, thanks for talking with us today. Good luck with the book. And that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back with another interview soon. I'm Michelle Grattan.